Captain Radio.
Well, you know, the crime that we are sort of forced to watch on the news and hear about on a very commonly daily basis is something that we feel that we have no control over. Joining me in the studio now is Dr. Stephen Monteroso. He's a senior lecturer here at Curtin University, the Faculty of Business and Law. Thank you for joining us today, Stephen.
Pleasure, Jenny.
This area that you're involved in, it's not just what we're going to speak about today, the anti-bikie laws. What other areas do you hone in on?
Principally, I deal with juvenile justice. So there's been a lot of research into, for example, Banksy Hill and so on in recent times. But yeah. Outlaw motorcycle gang research is really quite interesting, and it's also very topical and popular, we've seen. So I'm not sure that's a good thing, but that's what's happened.
Well, I was saying to you a little bit earlier, it's not that we are excited about this entertainment factor involved. It's the shock that it happens, and why do they become that way? I guess it's monetary based.
Sure.
Has to be. But, you know, the news headlines is always tabloid. It's either empathy, sadness, it's either something that's funny, or it's a shock.
Yep.
And this is why the public show an interest in crime, because they think, how do they do this, and why do they do this? Can we just touch on the juvenile crime at Bankshear? That was horrific. Is there any, with research that you do into this, you go into what? Why it happened? What are the conditions like? That sort of thing?
Yeah, Banksy Hill's an interesting case. It's, there's been a big decline in Banksy from, let's say, the early 2000s, when it was seen as something of a shining light with juvenile detention. But it's deteriorated, and we've seen inhumane treatment, and as you've seen recently, Cleveland Dodd's terrible demise in there. It was a real decline overall in the treatment of juveniles. And of course, what happens is they will be released. There's no doubt about that. And when they come out, if they've been treated inhumanely,
they're worse.
They're going to more than likely be a worse offender, and then escalate into adult criminality.
Where the heck did we go wrong?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like the public wants people to be incarcerated and also punished within, but the incarceration is the punishment. So if we treat them humanely and try to rehabilitate them and educate them,
different life.
There's a better chance they'll come out better and stop offending. Now, that's the aim. Some don't, of course. But if you treat them inhumanely, whether they're juveniles or adults, when they get out, and they will, because there's very few life sentences out there, then that's actually worse for society, in my view.
How come that we all know that you have to treat human beings? I know they've done some terrible things, but yes, certainly re-educate and let them know that there is a different life out there. How the heck didn't they know that? Don't they know that?
They should have, but a lot of them come from, you know, troubled backgrounds. And
not the people in jail, but the people that are running the jail, running programs.
Yeah.
Why don't... Isn't that an obvious thing?
It seems that the government these days, I used to think it was a right-wing thing, but I think it's infected the left now. It's tough on crime rhetoric. It doesn't actually work. Statistically, it doesn't work, but the average punter voter thinks it does, and so that's why you have premiers standing up saying, we're going to get tough on crime, not just here, but elsewhere. And that's not the way to approach it, because we've seen it doesn't work.
It doesn't work, no. The public want to hear that because they're angry. I mean, exactly. We look at the crime that's been going on around Australia, over the last week or so. People are angry. That's what it is, and they want revenge.
Exactly.
Get them in jail. Get them off the street. That's fine. They should have that sentence. But you're right. They need then, while in there, having programs to say, okay, let's look at life in the better way for you.
Yeah.
Has that been tried? That program ever been tried?
Well, it's supposed to happen all the time.
Yes.
But it's just that, for example, at Banksy Hill, when you have, you know, young people in 23-hour lockdown, they're clearly not getting access to education or mental health, you know, treatment.
Are they understaffed?
I think they are, and I think it's difficult for the government to actually get. I've noticed they're advertising for youth custodial officers, etc. And that's important, because youth custodial officers and adult prison guards are not the same thing, and so sometimes if they import them to Banksia or Unit 18 at Casuarina, they're not the people that should be looking after young offenders, in my view.
We do have to look at it, because it's such a cycle.
It is very much a cycle.
And that's the future.
Yep.
Oh my goodness, it must be very hard to sort of put all this information together and just say, for goodness sake, let's do something right now.
Yeah, we need to do things differently, but it's a very hard sell politically.
But is there a good program elsewhere around the world?
Would you believe...
A model.
Yeah, would you believe California has dismantled juvenile detention? What they've done is they've gone for community-based treatment, and crime rates have gone down and offending has gone down, of course.
That makes sense.
Now, the difficult thing is selling it. Now, if they can do it, I don't see why we can't, but as I said, it's the punitive tough-on-crime rhetoric is what a lot of people understand to be effective. Probably being suspicious, they probably know it maybe doesn't, but they like to think that, you know, tough-on-crime works, and we've just seen it.
We've got to try it.
Yeah,
we have to try it. Well, the information that you glean and the research that you do, who do you present this to?
Well, we publish papers and we present at conferences and so on. I just did a recent conference regarding Banksia Hill and the issues that have occurred there. And I even talked about some overseas jurisdictions, Scotland as well, which doesn't have a lot in common with us, really. They've also dismantled juvenile detention and their rates of crime are down.
There you go.
So. Yeah. But it's, as I said, it's a really difficult political sell.
If they don't know a different lifestyle when they are released, how the heck are they going to get exactly. to know about it on the outside?
And, of course, the more times they're in detention or in prison for adult offenders, the more they learn from other inmates and the harder they get. And, again, they escalate into a more serious offending.
And they're very angry.
Yep,
come out very
much.
Angry. Today you're going to talk about research that you've done into, like you were mentioning, we were mentioning earlier, about the WA anti-bikey laws that were hailed for damaging gang recruitment. But the question has come up now. Are they really working? What's happened?
Well, my personal feeling is having prohibition on insignias and so on, I think that makes the public feel a bit better about things. But I'm not sure it has a dramatic effect on offending. I think a lot of course, association between bikies is in the shadows, so to speak, rather than out in public. Now, I've known that we know that the police minister and others have mentioned that, oh, if they can't wear their insignia, then they can't get together in public. But, you know, New South Wales, they've taken it one step further. They have no bikie runs, no insignia in public, and no actual clubhouses, which we still have here. And, of course, gangs in New South Wales are operating perfectly fine, and a lot of them are operating from overseas bases. So if they get out of New South Wales, they might go to Turkey or to, Spain, Malta.
Bikie groups are linked with overseas groups, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
So we're talking at international.
It's a very much an international
that can happen.
Giant criminal kind of conspiracies.
That's a very difficult thing to control. And like you were saying earlier, I mean, they're very obvious, aren't they? Where
they
we
are.
Had underworld crime years ago, the mafia were sort of not out there waving a flag.
That's right. They kept under the radar.
Well,
yeah, exactly.
The police force obviously knew where they were,
sure.
But they weren't out there sort of.
They weren't advertising.
Here we are advertising. Yeah. That's the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
I wonder why they wear it like a badge of honour. Is it they feel they have more control?
You're talking about bikies?
Yeah.
Well, it just associates them with the gang and so on, and the tattoos and so on.
Like a club feeling.
Yeah. It's a camaraderie. Outlaw gangs typically were created after the end of the Second World War with disaffected soldiers. And when they came back, they were often treated quite badly by society, particularly Vietnam.
Yeah.
And so what do? They found camaraderie in outlaw gangs. They found that brotherhood. And so that's the good side of it.
Yeah.
The bad side is the criminal activities and the extortion
it's
and the money
extreme.
Laundering.
So is that the attraction, or has been, for younger people to join up? They feel a bit disenchanted with life. They are seeked out by the gangs, perhaps looking for recruitment?
Actually, what it is, you've heard the term Nike bikey. So what's happened in recent years is we've had this influx of young people who certainly aren't going to wear flannel and drive right Harley Davidsons. They're more Armani than flannel, and they're more German black SUV than Harley Davidson. So for them, it's about getting what they can out of the gang. So they're not about the traditional bikey way of life. They're actually about having the criminal contacts and networking that allows them to push drugs, for example. That's the aim of the game. Once again, you follow the money. That's where the criminality is.
How do they get to? They all know these younger people that feel as though they're not fitting into society. Perhaps a bit vulnerable. They seek it out. Do they?
Yeah, they're seeking criminal opportunity.
They are. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Rather than the disaffected Vietnam vet who just wanted to be accepted by somebody.
Yeah.
This is not the same thing.
So what are we going to do about this now?
Well, yeah. So we've got these new laws that ban insignia and so on. Just as an example, in Queensland, I think it was, they also banned insignia. So what one of the gangs did, they simply went out and bought a whole bunch of American college basketball gear, and they all wore the same singlets, etc. So what do you do? Do you ban that?
Yeah, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very tough call, isn't it? And I can't help but admire the police force for what they do. It's not an ideal situation. How big is the bikies and the crime combination situation in WA?
Interestingly, I've heard conflicting reports. My feeling is in the drug trade and firearm trafficking, bikies are very big. I have heard some reports suggesting, well, they're not that much into crime, but overall I'd say they are. And I know that besides firearm trafficking and drug, the drug trade is massive. I think it's an $8 million a day.
A day?
Yep. Bikies around Australia, their income, if you like, or their operating finances are $8 million a day. I think it's $3 billion a year.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's a huge... And, of course, everything's leveraged off that. So firearms are leveraged off drug trafficking because drug traffickers need guns and so on and so forth. So it's one of those cycles that drags people in for the financial rewards. And so these young Nike bikies, no interest in being a traditional 1%er bearded kind of flannel wearing bikie, but they're very interested in making money out of drug trafficking.
Yeah.
That's the attraction.
It's a big business, isn't it? I'll tell you what, if you don't mind, we'll just have a break.
Sure.
We'll come back. If anyone has a question for you, and they can ring on 948-41927. And in the studio, we thank very much Dr. Stephen Monterosa, Curtin University Law School organised crime expert. There's crime will always be out there, won't it, in one form or another.
When there's money to be made, there'll be crime.
Yes. It's not always just for survival, is it?
No, it's... In my view, you follow the money. So if you want to stop outlaw motorcycle gangs, as in other gangs, follow the money, and you use things like money laundering laws, unexplained wealth laws, property confiscation laws. In my experience as a researcher, that's how you reduce criminality rather than necessarily stopping people wearing a shirt.
Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? Have we done that before in a smaller way?
Well, the laws are out there, and police have used them, but I just think they need to be strengthened, and I think that's the way that you reduce criminality. And I think a lot of reduction in the use of insignia or tattoos or whatever, I mean, it probably has some effect, but it doesn't have the same effect as targeting the revenue stream, which is
what it's all about,
basically.
Would that have to go through a court of law, legislated that property would be?
Yeah, but if the laws are in place, then a court of law can uphold those, once we prove beyond reasonable doubt, etc. They can uphold those laws. Don't forget, Al Capone was got through tax evasion, everything else failed. Follow the money.
Well, if it's that obvious, I mean, surely we don't want this to continue. We don't want our young people going into this situation.
And no, we don't.
We've had murders, as a result of gang warfare, I suppose, and that's been going on forever. It's when the mafia used to do that, didn't they?
It is, and it's the money, actually. And there is personality clashes, etc. But this all went back to Milperra in 1984 on Father's Day when Australia first saw bikie violence with actual shootings, and in fact an innocent young lady was killed as well because they were at a swap meet. But before that, it was more like, oh, they're just bikies, they can do what they like to each other, they don't really worry us. But in fact, nowadays they do, because they are in a huge part of the drug trafficking and firearm trafficking trade, if you like.
Is this pretty much all around the world?
Yeah, bikies have bases in just about everywhere you can think of. Even countries you think would have no business having bikie gangs have them, and they're often linked. You know, there's chapters around the world, and they're very powerful. Even things like trademark law, like the Hell's Angel, I think it's a Indian chief insignia, that is one of the most heavily protected trademarks on earth, because there's money to be made from it. So anyone trying to sell some rip-off t-shirts with that insignia, they'll be sued.
Is that linked to the bikie trade, is it?
Yeah, because the Hell's Angels, that's their insignia.
How far back does this go?
The Indian chief, a long time. The Hell's Angels, I think, the oldest outlaw gang.
Okay, you say after the Vietnam War, which is understandable, they were treated.
This is actually after the Second World War.
That's what I was wondering. Yeah. How far back further did that go?
Yeah, it all goes back to an incident called the Hollister incident in 1947 in the US, where the famous phrase 1%ers was coined, because there was a gang of motorcyclists, and they started arcing up and causing trouble in a Midwestern town, somewhere in California. And the mayor, I think it was, or the chief of police said, you know, 99% of the bikers are law-abiding citizens, so the 1% became a famous badge of honour, which we still have.
Yeah. Why is it, do you think, that these people in big business, it's all about money, if you had the mafia, they'd be in glamorous vehicles. Why the bikes?
Well, it's interesting. They you know, it's a symbol of being an outlaw motorcycle rider, but as we mentioned before with the Nike bikers, a lot of them don't even have bikes, so they're not actually... They're in the club for the reasons of criminal networking, etc. So, as I said, flannel out, our money in. They're not going to look like the traditional bike, and they're certainly not going to ride a motorbike.
They're businessmen.
They're business people, yeah. Or they're young, wannabe career criminals who are seduced by the
So we're always going to have a dysfunctional situation out there with a whole lot of young people that don't feel they fit in. They have mental health issues and that sort of thing, and I can't make any money, I can't keep a job, that sort of thing. So they're the people. How do you get to them, I suppose, if you could, when you have been successful so far? Why is it breaking down, do you think?
I think we need to take a different approach, as I said.
In the jails to start
with? Well, for starters, we need to treat people better in prisons, because the incarceration is the punishment, as I said before.
Yeah.
So they need to be educated, rehabilitated. A lot of them, like we've had a lot of students who have studied our degrees actually in prison, and you like to think when they get out, at least they've got a degree or some sort of qualification to start afresh, because leaving prison is a very difficult thing. Often they come out with no money, they can't actually rent anywhere to live.
Exactly.
And what happens? They invariably drift back to crime. So the better tools, if you like, we can give them while they're in prison. And this is not about being soft on crime. They're already convicted and they're already incarcerated.
They're already punished. Yeah.
They're already punished, in my view. So there's no benefit treating prisoners, or whether young or old, inhumanely, because that will absolutely lead to worse consequences for society.
Yeah, well, I'm just hoping that all that you have offered, this information to others with all your research, that people are going to take it up. It just makes so much more sense.
I think the government are aware. For example, I remember speaking to the police minister a long time ago when they were in opposition, and he was a big fan of the Texas Justice Reinvestment Program, which took money away from prisons instead of spending millions more on more prisons in Texas. And they actually targeted community-based rehabilitation and therapy, and they were getting very good results. And I remember he was a big fan of that. The problem, of course, when you're in government, it's, as I said, it's a difficult political sell.
It's got to be popular.
Yeah.
Yes, you're absolutely right. But we, listening to what you're saying, makes so much sense, and this message has to get out. It really does. It can happen to your neighbour's child. It can happen to one of your own children.
Of course,
if they go off track or get onto drugs and go the wrong way. It is a very frightening situation.
Definitely.
And we, the public, have to stop thinking. You're right. We have to think completely different. Yes, they've gone to jail. Yes, they're out off the streets. But yes, they have to get out eventually.
They will get out eventually.
They will get out eventually. Yeah. And that cycle just keeps going and going and going, doesn't it?
Sure.
That's very interesting. So how long are you going to stay with this particular area of crime?
Well, yeah, I think I might stay for a while yet, because there's always something new happening. And as I said, these laws, the anti-association laws that we also have, they actually target, you know, a bit like anti-terrorism laws, they target association with certain people rather than a traditional criminal sanction that occurs because someone's broken the law. So in a way, a civil libertarian, for example, would not be happy with anti-consorting laws, because you're actually invading people's right to associate with people. And so that's my feeling. It's not the best way to try to tackle crime, anti-association type laws, because they're not proven to be very effective at all.
Not, no.
I know that the media have talked and the government have talked about the success of these anti-consorting laws. I'll be the first to congratulate them if it works, but my personal feeling is, as I've said a number of times, if you follow the money, that's how you reduce criminality.
They have to listen.
They do.
It just makes so much sense, and I hope that from time to time it can come back down and speak to the mothers and fathers, grandparents, that sort of thing, about your attitude to all of this. And hopefully,
some people don't want to hear it. I remember talking at a conference once, and an elderly couple, they were going to lynch me after, but 20 minutes later, we were all mates, because I explained.
Yes, exactly.
That if a 13-year-old boy goes to detention, and at the age of 15 goes back, because recidivism is very common amongst juvenile offenders, and their recidivism rates are getting higher and higher, unfortunately. So statistics show that the more a juvenile offender returns to detention, the more likely they are to be an adult offender. It's obvious.
It is obvious.
So if we can just try and break that cycle somewhere along the line, earlier the better, to be honest. that'd be a good thing for society.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Look, we thank you so much for explaining that in such a clear way. It really does make a lot of sense, and hopefully you can come back and give us some better news.
Sure,
in the near future. Thank you very much, Dr. Stephen Monterosa.